Okay, well, thank you everybody for being here. And we haven't talked a lot about magnetic field during the program yet, some during the mini conference, but I thought it would be interesting to try to see something about a very simple topic I've put here, the scaling laws for the dynamo, hoping that some can be extrapolated and used in the exoplanetary context. But what I'm going to present is really nothing extremely profound, just more some introduction. And I think that we can, and I've had not prepared too many slides on this topic, but some to answer possible questions. But I think this could open the debate on people like Eric and Alex, and probably others could probably add up on the things they've done or have thought about. So the question I put was really in this exoplanet spirit, try to see what could we say about the magnetic field that your planet could produce. And specifically, I will address two questions, simple questions. Given the radius mass of your planet and its orbital period, how large magnetic field can you expect? And I will mention three points, three approaches. The magnetostrophic ID, force balance argument, which can be used to deduce something about the intensity of the magnetic field. Scaling laws derived from numerical simulations, and we've heard a little bit already about that by John Orme last week. And a new approach that we've been proposing for the Earth, which can be extended for planets, I think, which would be interesting. I've tried while I was here, in fact, to modify a little bit my programs linked, it's very simple programs linked to this approach to give it more universal type behavior. And finally, I thought it was maybe also interesting to talk about the reversals of the magnetic field. So we have no observation of an exoplanet's magnetic field yet, but maybe once we'll have some, and then we might ask the question, how often it reverse, and will we see that? Well, just some very simple ideas. And I'm talking only here about dynamo generated magnetic field. I assume that someday we might find a planet which is very cold and made of iron, oxidized iron, and might have retained some fossil magnetic field, but that's not the question addressed here. It would be fun to have a big magnet like Gilbert, imagine 400 years ago floating somewhere.
That planet is Mars.
Do you think so?
Fossil field.
It has some fossil field, but in the crust. I was thinking of the big thing, the whole core made of magnetite. But okay, we'll concentrate on dynamo-generated magnetic fields. And you know very well that the very simple equation we have to relate to comes from these pre-Maxwell electromagnetic equations. No dipole, no magnetic monopole. Faraday's law with we have some light velocities in our flows. Ohm's law and Ampere's law, which relate the electric currents to the magnetic field. And we use these two in the following to show the difference between the behavior. And when we combine these four laws,
Are there no charge densities ever, so that Gauss's law for electric fields is just left out?
It's true. For iron cores, I'm not talking about plasma things, then the electric field has negligible contribution. It's present, of course, in Ohm's law, that's important, but it's all neutral, I think there is no...
Yeah. So it's an induced electric field, but not due to charge density?
Yes. And so when we combine these four equations, we get what we call the induction equation, which tells us that if the flow is present in some electrically conductive fluid, which has a conductivity sigma, the magnetic field can be generated by dynamo action by this induction term and is dissipated by this dissipation term, the diffusion term of the magnetic field. And of course, the whole point for people working on geodynamo in particular is to try to figure out when and how and where you get some induction which is large enough to encompass magnetic diffusion. So you see, it's a very simple equation with just one physical parameter here, which is the magnetic diffusivity, 1 over mu 0 times sigma. So we can rewrite that same equation with a non-dimensional number, with a magnetic Reynolds number, which is just like the classical kinetic Reynolds number, except we have the magnetic diffusivity here instead of the kinematic viscosity. Okay, so now we have that induction equation. That's part of the problem. It tells us if we have velocity field, we can produce magnetic field by this effect. Then, of course, we have a fluid which is being in motion because of thermal convection in some rotating planet. So we have to take into account the Navier-Stokes equation. And we'll do that just for discussing this question of the magnetostrophic equilibrium, which is being used in this context. So the Navier-Stokes equation, the fluid motion, has these inertial terms. This is because we are on a rotating planet, we have this Coriolis term. This is pressure gradient. The Lorentz force, some buoyancy force, which is driving the flow. And finally, viscous dissipation. So this is the classical equation we have. And we think that in the context of planetary cores, many of these terms are very small. So to take the example of the Earth, at least, we think that this term, the inertial term, is very small, at least at the integral large scale. The viscosity term is very small. The buoyancy term, which is driving the flow, is still not playing a dominant role, we think. And this led to the idea that the dominant forces remaining, the only ones really, were the Coriolis force and the Coriolis term, if you want, and the Lorentz force. Which therefore should balance each other. And this leads to what's been called the Elsasser number. It's basically just trying to evaluate the ratio of the Lorentz force to the Coriolis term. And it's expected that in these conditions, the magnetic field should adjust in some way so that this number is of only one. This is the basic idea behind this magnetostrophic equilibrium, which is still something people are working on for Earth dynamo at the moment. And then there are two ways, in a sense, to estimate this term, in particular the Lorentz force. You could use Ohm's law. Again, Ohm's law here tells you how to relate the electric current density to this mu cross B term. So if you have some magnetic field and some flow, they interact, you get some J, which is just proportional to sigma UB from Ohm's law. If you do that, you see that the U term disappears, and basically you find directly an expression of the magnetic field B as a function of omega, the rotation velocity, and the magnetic diffusivity. I've written here the intensity of the magnetic field in alpha wave velocity, as we often do because it's very convenient. We can compare more easily flow velocities and magnetic field intensities. And also, we don't have to worry about CGS or SI units or things like that. So with this definition of the alpha wave velocity in the SI units, you simply get from that balance a very simple relationship, which tells you directly that the intensity of magnetic field depends on the rotation rate and the magnetic diffusivity and nothing else. But in fact, if you are in a dynamo, it's not very reasonable to estimate the electric current intensity from the Ohm's law. And you have that other relation which tells you that electric currents are related to the magnetic field through Ampere's law. So if you do that from Ampere's law, then you get something different. Ampere's law tells you that J is rotational of B, so you get B again, like we had, so B squared this time, and something which is related to the time scale on which you get the electric currents. And in fact, it's through that length scale, LB. So if you have electric currents which are more concentrated, that's how you can get larger magnetic field. So there is this ratio, like the integral scale of the system, radius of the core, for example, divided by the typical length scale of the magnetic field, which can be much smaller. And then you get that the intensity of the magnetic field depends on the rotation again, but with some factor here which can depend on the vigor of convection. It's a vigor of convection through the magnetic storms number. And that vigor presumably is linked to the available power. So already you get difference from that you find, which seems more reasonable, that the intensity of the magnetic field is not only controlled by the rotation of the planet. But still, it's in this idea of magnetostrophic regime. And another, just a word about Alphen waves, because I've been relating to these and I'll be relating again. So this is Alphen. In 1942, he proposed that when you have these two equation of motion and induction equation, if you can get coupled and you can have waves that propagate along field lines. So you have an imposed magnetic field line, and you kind of punish or take the field line, you pull it and you let it go. Triggers a wave for which the restoring force is the Lorentz force, and it can propagate along this field line. And so that's when you have some strong imposed large-scale magnetic field B, and then you can derive the equation for a small-scale little b and little u, which are the ones linked to the wave itself. So you can linearize this equation, the Navier-Stokes equation and the induction equation, and then when you combine them using, in particular, introducing Elsasser variables, which is u plus or minus the Alphen B, you find that it is indeed a wave equation. You see here du dt related to the gradient of u. These are the dissipation terms linked to both viscosity and magnetic diffusivity. And in the ideal case, when you neglect all these, you really find something which is like wave equation. Du dt equals b grad dot grad of u, these Elsasser variables, when you have no diffusivities. And there are some nice properties of these waves, and I'm showing here a little movie which shows what happens if you actually propagate one of these waves. So you have a string magnetic field line, and you punch it here. You have this B starting value, and it will propagate both ways with this little u. If I can start a movie, because I have always problems starting movies for some reason.
Okay.
Yeah. So you see the wave which has either plus or minus for U and B, one way or the other. There is some boundary here, so it will reflect and go back. There is some absorption there, linked to the presence of a boundary layer, so you lose a little bit of amplitude. But otherwise, you see that the Alphen waves are linear waves. They can cross each other without deforming. That's an important thing for turbulent-related problem. It's a transverse wave, that is, if you have a magnetic field like this, the motion will be transverse to the direction of propagation, which is the magnetic field lines. So this wave is transverse. It's non-dispersive. It propagates at the Alphen wave velocity. And one important point is that you see that when this wave decreases because of dissipation, magnetic diffusion in particular, and reflections, it still keeps an equal energy in kinetic U and magnetic energy B. And that's an important feature of this MHD wave, this Alphen wave, and the turbulence which can be linked to these waves. Okay, I close this parenthesis to go back to scaling laws, because another approach which has been used and extensively used is if we're able to make some numerical simulations of, say, the geodynamo, that's where it started, we should be able to see how the intensity of the produced magnetic field relates to input parameters. And that's something which has been in particular developed by Christensen and Aubert in 2006. And here they're showing some number which is basically linked to the intensity of the magnetic field related to the input parameters of the various large number of simulations they've performed, something which is related to the vigor of convection and the magnetic Prandtl number. And they find that, in fact, indeed, they can align these points, all these simulation results, on one big single line. So that there is a simple relationship between the intensity of the magnetic field and these input parameters. And one way, I like the one that Eric has used in his 2010 paper, he finds that the intensity of the magnetic field, given again as Alphen wave velocity, is simply proportional to the power 1/3 of something which is like P, which is the power input you give to the system. In your case, everything's more like entropy times T, but it's more or less equivalent. This, by the way, these are all simulations which are done neglecting the compressibility effects anyway. So it's more Poussinesque type computation. So P multiplied by the radius of the outer core divided by the mass of the outer core. So a very simple relationship which directly relates the intensity of the magnetic field and the available power P and nothing else.
Did you define the magnetic Prandtl number before?
Not yet. No, I can do it. Yeah, it's a good idea because I'll use it afterwards. In fluid mechanics, we have these hundreds of various So that one, Pm, compares the viscosity of the fluid with the magnetic diffusivity of the fluid. And typically for liquid metals, and that will be very important, Pm is of order 10 to the minus 6, something like that. So it's a very small number. It means magnetic diffusivity is much more important than viscosity for dissipating. Okay, so that was something quite important. And this particular relationship has been used by many people for many contexts, and in particular, Alex wanted this, to me, this article I had forgotten about. Christensen and some astrophysicist colleagues were bold enough to apply this relationship to the magnetic field of Earth, Jupiter, and a bunch of stars, finding that they could indeed reproduce more or less the trend that they observed in these families of very different objects, which might have or might not have the same origin in terms of dynamo generated things. Sun-like stars are not in this diagram. They simply have different mechanism. These are rapidly rotating stars.
So I'm slightly confused now. You have given three arguments, and in one you said magnetic field depends only on rotation. The second you said on rotation and available power, and the third only on power.
Yeah. So then you've exactly found where there is some problem in the geodynamo community at the moment. And that's one way I want to give a few more things about that. This law, which you see is has been very widely used and seems very powerful, has been severely criticized. And we've seen some at the mini conference already. For one thing, people right away, and I can't remember exactly what it was, I think maybe Sokolov or somebody like that, pointed out that when you plot the log of something times x versus the log of something else times x, you always find something which looks like good correlation. And there is a little bit of that in what Christensen and Ober have done. That is, they have rescaled their axis to take into account the power, which is not an input parameter, but something they put on a bit on both sides. That's true. So that's one question. Another thing which has been pointed out by John Ornu at the mini conference was what he calls the chimney effect. It's a bit related, this idea that you have this big slope, but in fact, when you look in detail, you have like little various trends which have a different slope. Okay, it's true. It doesn't, for me, say that it doesn't work exactly, but it's different. More important, well, that one is a bit strange. Oruba and Dormi said that they were really very aggressive to this law because they say it has no predicting power. It just says that the input energy you have in the system is dissipated at some place. I think that's not right. It's too strong. I mean, they stated too strongly. I don't think it's right. But there is also a little bit of that. And maybe the more important thing for our community, the geodynamo, which also implies probably for other planets, is that these numerical simulations might not be in the magnetostrophic regime that we expect for planetary cores, but in a more viscously controlled regime. And in fact, recently, Oruba and Dormi, taking the same simulation that they got from the Christensen, basically, produced an alternative scaling which fits well the data, and which is something like that. So again, you find this square root of omega, but with new instead of the kinematic viscosity instead of magnetic diffusivity, which seems to indicate that you are not with this control of the magnetic field, but times some square root of something which is related to the Grelian number, that is to the vigor of convection, and therefore to the power input. So it's not in contradiction, but they wanted to stress that in fact there was some relationship with omega, even though it seemed to be hidden in the other previous relationship. And also that in the simulations, we haven't reached this magnetostrophic regime, but it's still viscously controlled mostly.
Would it be fair to say that the underlying theme here is that the simulations are very expensive, and people want to find some nice analytic law, but basically there isn't one?
Oh, maybe not there is not one, but maybe there is one for that regime, but that regime might not be the one you expect for the core. And in fact, that's what... And that's what's been explored also. Because there is... well, I mentioned here that the magnetic Prandtl number for liquid metals is very small. In numerical simulations, you can't solve something in which you have things happening on one scale and the other one which is 10 to the 1 million times larger. So all simulations are done with a more moderate magnetic Prandtl number, like 1. And that can make quite a difference. And we'll see a slide which shows that in more detail. Maybe I can
show it. So why not just do the simulation? I mean, it's not like you actually have to do real experiments. Why not simulate what you actually care about?
Care about what?
Why not use simulations that have the relevant parameters for our problem?
Oh, because it's impossible.
Why?
Just for what I said, we don't know how to solve these equations, Navier-Stokes and induction equation, taking into account a range of a factor of a million between the magnetic diffusivity and the kinetic viscosity, for example.
Well, okay, if it's that hard, then why would you think you could simulate something that's different and extrapolate to predict the results of the simulation?
Okay, that's an excellent question. One of the reasons was, and that was what Christensen and Ober put forward, is that in that relationship, you have no diffusivities at all entering the problem. So they thought that basically their scaling law was fine. You were in a regime in which diffusivities were not important anymore.
Well, not completely. I have to jump in here because the power term does actually incorporate that. It's essentially your available entropy that is left to drive the dynamo after you take into account, for example, thermal diffusivity, which will tend to shut it down.
Okay, yeah, that's one point. You're right. I haven't discussed here. We're talking about the available power for
the excess
field. You have to drive convection first. In particular, we discussed with Buffett. The mini conference, the question of this adiabatic gradient, which makes that much of the heat which is coming out of the core is lost for the dynamo. It's just conducted along the adiabat with no interest. That's, yeah, of course, it's an important one. But I think I jump to this slide. I have Eric to answer your question more easily. I think. Get back to this slide after that. Oh, that far? Okay, never mind. This is the preview. Okay. I was supposed to write here later, but that's fine. This is a compilation that Nathanael Schaefer and my team has done from all available numerical simulations, which shows the intensity of, well, this time it's the ratio of velocity over magnetic field. And as a function of this magnetic Prandtl number, which I mentioned was one of the difficult things to model, the Earth, we think, is somewhere around here. We'll get back to that. That's very important. It means it has a small kinetic energy as compared to its magnetic energy, like a factor of 10,000. Big difference. And it has a small magnetic Prandtl number. Nathanael put it at 10 to minus 5 here. I think it's probably a bit less even, but okay, that's fine. And here we have a bunch of numerical simulations, because that's where we can have dynamos working. And you see that they are more like around magnetic Prandtl number of 1, or a bit larger, or a bit less. And they all have the failing sense to reach this property of having a very large magnetic energy. Except for, this is one computation by Garrick Laxmeyer some long time ago, where there you can get some large magnetic field. When you have very large magnetic Prandtl number, which is not realistic at all for the Earth, but that's one way you can reach this. And seeing that Nathanael has been working on now, these red dots, in fact, where he tries to go in the direction of the Earth by lowering the magnetic Prandtl number. And you see that there is some hope that it might actually go in the right direction. But all the green dots here are these Christensen and Robert simulations. And you see that they kind of cluster around here. So they might not be, in fact, in this regime that we expect for the Earth. At least they fail some of the criteria, like having this very large magnetic field. OK, I jumped a bit too far ahead of myself, but
I'm wondering, is there any importance to the size of the dot?
Oh, the size, the surface of the dots, Natal tells me, is the magnitude of the magnetic reference number in the simulation or estimated for the Earth.
So, do I understand correctly that the specific difficulty of the numerical simulations is that because of the Prandtl number, you must simultaneously simulate large and tiny scales? Yes. So your number of points that you need is just choose a large number.
Yeah. And I've put the emphasis on the magnetic Prandtl number, but it's true, of course, if you look like at the, if you compare viscosity with rotation, you get the same type of problem.
Where would be Jupiter on this
video? Oh, in terms of well, the short answer is that we have no idea, because we have no idea of what is the kinetic energy for Jupiter's dynamo, I think. It would be fair to say. But you've seen on the previous plot that still you could plot Jupiter as the Earth on this kind of general trend, as far as the magnetic field is concerned with this relationship with the Earth.
I didn't understand that. Do you understand the answer that you got? I mean, I thought that Jupiter's interior velocities were fairly well known, and the same with the Sun.
Oh, no. Well, you're talking about velocities like we see in the wind, the surface of
Jupiter. No, I was thinking convective velocities. Are they not relevant?
No, I think we have no idea, but maybe I'm wrong. Where would you get that from?
Well, I would think that the interior, I'm not an expert, but I would have think, I'm fairly sure that the interior of the Sun, in terms of its convective velocities, is fairly well known, because the energy transport is so well constrained by the models matching luminosity and radius. And the same for Jupiter, for which there's net heat flow that's measured, and the structure of Jupiter is well measured. So I would have thought a dot. In fact, ironically, it's surprising the Earth is there, and I guess the only reason the Earth gets to be there is because of seismology. Is that right? In other words, you know that the velocities are small for the Earth.
No, it's not from seismology. It's from, should I jump to that thing? Maybe. Because I'm going to use this, in fact. For the Earth, we think we know independently, so to say, the intensity of the magnetic field and the intensity of the flow velocities which are driving the dynamo. And that's mostly from observation of the evolution of the magnetic field with time. You remember this movie that Bruce, I guess, showed? You see over 400 years that there are some patches of magnetic field which kind of move around on the Earth. And from that, you derive velocities which are of the order of millimeters per second.
But isn't that, I'm really naive here, so I apologize, but it seems like that's somewhat circular. I mean, you're using the theory of the dynamo to infer the velocities that cause the changes in the dynamo on the Earth.
No, you're just...
You're not measuring those velocities. And again, I would think that in an environment that's got, nearly ideal gas conditions like the Sun, and almost true for Jupiter...
You're just using time-dependent Maxwell equations.
The induction equation.
So you're saying that those are more secure?
I hope so.
Yeah, well, they're separate. I mean, you could have the field generated by some of those mechanisms, which would be strange, but then other than the dynamo in the Earth, but still see that the patches are moving. And if diffusion is not too strong, they are moving really because they are affected by the flow.
Bruce Buffett gave us
Okay.
And for the Sun, it's different. I think we'll see that one of the main controls here is really the energy available for driving the dynamo, which and that will be true for all planets, I think, is not very large. I mean, they've seen some laser points because they were kind of marginal. You might as well not have a dynamo because there is just not enough power to make it work. For the Sun, it's really very different. I mean, the power available is not a problem, I think. And you're right, we know probably quite well the velocity. For Jupiter, I'm still... we might be in... good position to do a lot more once we have these results, which might show some circular variation of Jupiter's magnetic field. Then we might be in the same position.
I guess a good question would be whether you know the magnetic parameter number of metallic hydrogen very well. Yeah, we do.
That's something different. I think it's also small. Maybe not as small as 10 to minus 6.
Is it possible that, you know, this line of reasoning that you might make use of Jupiter and the Sun and other stars and their magnetic fields is sort of fundamentally wrong, in that the domains are so different of density and temperature and viscosity and Prandtl number for the Earth, for Jupiter and the Sun? I mean, there might be something that we would call dynamos, but they're so utterly different in the scales, relative viscosities and Prandtl numbers, that it doesn't help you to learn it, you know, learning well one environment doesn't inform you very well about a different environment.
It could be, but I'm not sure. So far, it doesn't seem that it's so far. The galaxy operates in such a different regime. Well, they operate in a different regime, but there are some common points. In terms of the magnetic Prandtl number, for example, I know that for the Sun, it's supposed also to be somewhat small, but fairly long. And we've seen that in this intensity plot, we could put stars and Jupiters and things on more or less the same scale.
Why was it that you said Christensen did not put Sun-like stars or the Sun on that plot? How is the Earth more similar to a high-mass star than it is to the Sun?
Yeah, rotation. That was his idea behind. If you compare differential rotation of the Sun, as we know from heliosismology, to global rotation, this number is of order one. It's not very small. Whereas for the Earth, we can see right now, in fact, that what we call the Rossby number, so the ratio of velocities as compared to Coriolis, is like 10 to the minus 6. It's also a very small number for the core. And for these rapidly rotating stars, it's expected that it's also a small number.
Yeah. The stars there are kilogauss fields, right?
Yeah. Alex, can you remember? I guess on the scale we can see that.
Mean sequence.
The ones on the
brown dwarfs, that's really a very small number.
This is the intensity of the field in millitesla.
So yeah, so in reasonable units.
So it's like 10 to
kilogauss.
Right? This is 1 kilogauss.
That's kilogauss fields, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Sun is much less than a kilogauss.
If you take the dipole part, I think it's less.
So much less.
It probably doesn't fit on this line, otherwise, they would have put it.
There are some points that don't fit on the line, but they did put them. What are those?
That's true, and I don't remember.
In that diagram, he only goes to low mass stars. Okay. So that's, it doesn't reach up to the Sun.
Okay, I wanted to present to you another approach that we've developed, which might be of some interest for planets, although still debatable, I think. We developed for the Earth core, because of this question that we saw the simulations were not reaching the proper regimes and so on, what we've called turbulent scaling loads. And the idea is that in liquid metals, because this magnetic Prandtl number is small, it means that if you have a dynamo working, its magnetic Reynolds number must be large enough, like 100, so that you have a dynamo working. And then the Reynolds number, which is 1 million times larger, has to be large. And again, for that reason, we can't model that in molecular simulation. But we can try... Sorry?
Do you want to define the Reynolds number?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. You need a cheat sheet for all these dimensionless numbers.
So the Reynolds number is
the ratio of inertial viscous forces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the magnetic Reynolds number is exactly the same where you have magnetic diffusivity replacing viscosity.
Yeah.
And I could as well put the Rossby number, which is something like
the number is the ratio of Reynolds and kinetic Reynolds,
which compares velocities to rotation. So because of that, we thought that turbulence involves a large range of spatial and temporal scales. It goes from very large scales to dissipation scales, which are small. Numerical simulations can't cover that range. Observations, even for the Earth, don't do it either. But phenomena that we observe at a large scale can depend on small scales which are hidden. So we thought we'd develop something along these lines. trying to develop, to see what kind of turbulence we get and what it tells us about the intensity of the field. So here I'm recalling what we know about turbulence. We know a lot for hydrodynamic turbulence because engineers and mechanicians, physicists have worked on that for like more than one century. In that turbulence, it's a nonlinear term U dot grad U, which is important, which is making that you get all these different scales and so on, and cascades and so on, which is not what we'll have for a dynamo. That's one of the problems. But still, we can use this. And in a sense, that's a philosophical statement, but the role of turbulence appears very dull. It transfers energy from some large scale at which it is injected to small scales at which it can be dissipated by viscosity. In other words, the system, if you have large scale motions, is unable to dissipate all the energy you are putting in it. It has to cascade down to small scales to be able to do it. Okay? And this is, has led to this very well-known and very important idea of universal turbulence developed by Kolmogorov, in which when you plot the log of the kinetic energy density as a function of the log of the wave number at which you get this particular energy density, you get some, when you inject some power in the system at some given scale, it has to cascade down to some dissipation scale where you put motions close enough that the gradients are large enough that viscosity can play its role of dissipating energy. So this is called the dissipation range, and that one is the inertial range in which nothing else happens than just transferring from large scales to smaller scales in a fashion which can be, that was the input of Kolmogorov to show that this, the fact you're just transferring energy without dissipating tells you what this slope should be, energy versus k. And this is the famous k minus I squared scale. Okay, and where you jump from inertial range to dissipation range happens when you have the L scale Reynolds number, that is, if you define a Reynolds number like the one there, at the scale little l, the local scale rather than the large integral scale, that number is of order one when you go from one region to the other. And we'll be using this idea that, in fact, in, when you start adding some more ingredients, like the magnetic field and rotation, things always happen when you have some of this number which is close to one. It will be some other numbers, like the Rossby number or the Sassy number or something. And, okay, this, this is definition of this Reynolds number. And this leads to this famous Kolmogorov law. So the density energy at a wave number k is proportional to k minus 5/3. And there is, in front of that, this epsilon 2/3, which is important. It tells you that this is, epsilon is the input of energy per unit mass. So it tells you that if you inject more energy here, you will dissipate more, of course, at the end. But also it will move with respect to k. That is, if you put more energy in the system, you get larger velocities, and they will dissipate at shorter dimensions. So now for Planck recalls, what can we expect? This image is too small because it neglects, I've mentioned, the effect of rotation, the effect of magnetic field. And so we have tried to put this into context, and this is in the chapter of Treatise on Geophysics, which is supposed to appear sometime this year. And we've introduced for that what we call tau-L regime diagrams, which are very simple things, but which were very helpful. The idea is simply that since turbulence involves a wide range of scales, we want to relate the time scale tau of various phenomena to the length scale L as which is operate. You've seen that for Reynolds number, there is this length scale L at which you get a local small-scale Reynolds number of order 1. Time scale and length scale for example, viscous dissipation are related, like typical time scale would be L to the, L squared over viscosity. And so, again, regime changes occur when these tau L lines intersect. We can write most dimensionless numbers as time scale ratios, and we'll do that. And again, the scale L at which a dimensionless number is of order 1 is more important than the value of that number at the large scale, the integral scale. And finally, and that's an important assumption, we think that turbulent dynamics is controlled by the shortest timescale process. We see in particular that on the Earth spins in one day, that's a short scale, it will be much shorter than other timescales, and for that reason we think that any process which is taking place at scales, at timescales longer than a day, will be affected by the rotation of the Earth. So just to give you an example of what it does for us then, is if we plot here on the log scale, we have to do a log scale, land scale in meters, this is a diagram for the Earth. So from very small land scales like centimeters all the way to the radius of the outer core. And here we plot time scales in seconds, so like 100 seconds to million years. We can draw these lines which relate the various phenomena. This is the line which corresponds to viscous dissipation. So that one I can write maybe it's written, no, it's not written. This is a very simple relationship that for viscous dissipation, the typical time is related to the typical length scale divided by the actual kinematic viscosity of the fluid. And in that representation, for example, I put here what would be the Kolmogorov cascade you would get if you were to inject some velocities here at the larger scale, so with some typical time scale of several hundred years in that case. It would cascade down to dissipation where it intersects this viscous dissipation line, where the local Reynolds number is of order 1. And one interesting thing is that if you have a given core, with a given size, given mass, you can graduate that line in terms of pressure, of power. This intersection here of this line, if it happens at this particular small length scale of centimeters, will correspond to a global dissipation of about 1 terawatt. And the points here are like, this is 1 gigawatt, megawatt, kilowatt, what, very strongly on this line. So in a sense, if we're able to do that, knowing what is, for example, either the dissipation, if we start from here, and if we're able to reconstruct what cascade is pertinent for our problem, we could say what is the intensity of the magnetic field, for example, or velocity at this largest possible length scale, the scale of the Earth. So we've tried to play this exercise.
Okay. Yeah. So I think you brought me somewhere and I got confused.
Okay.
Follow this, but then you told me the scale was controlled by the length of the day, which is 10 to the 5.
This would be like six.
Yeah, so I put the Earth there, and then you talked about me about the rest of the diagram, and I didn't follow it, I guess. I think I understood some of it, but not all of it.
Okay, yeah. It's.
You distracted me, I'd say, by bringing my head over to that side time.
I see what you mean. Yeah. No, I tried. This is important because be using this diagram in various versions of it, so it's good if you spend some time to explain what we've been doing so that we can have a delay for what is not good.
But what I think you said for your takeaway message is that this is telling us that very short scales, sub-meter scales, are really where we're dissipating the power.
Yeah, that's what we see here. For example, with that diagram, which has some reasonable value of what is available power for Daimler, like 1 terawatt, we find that if we had a Kolmogorov cascade, simple one, with no rotation, no magnetic field, and so on, and that it actually follows this Kolmogorov law, then we probably are dissipating the energy at viscously at scales of a few centimeters on time scale of a few hours or so.
I'm trying to invert this in my head. Is the power set where the ordinate is in the group in the Kolmogorov line? So if how does that?
This is what you mean. What? How do I grab this?
Yeah, the intercept. Right. How does that Kolmogorov line change with increasing power, decreasing power?
Okay, why didn't you multiply E of K by some constant?
This is a log scale, so it it's the CUK.
This one's bosonic. So did you anchor it to the 1 terawatt, or did you anchor it to something? You did?
In that case, yes, I did.
So then, what? I don't understand how we've learned anything. If you just assume that you dissipate energy at centimeter scales, then you dissipate at centimeter scales. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to exercise to do the exercise the way it would be useful for exoplanets. When we did it for the Earth, we went the other way around. We thought that we knew what happened at the large scales because of observations, and we tried to say how much dissipation we would get.
But so how do you estimate U naught for the Earth then?
In here?
Yeah.
This is purely guessed by this constraint. I start from that, in this case, and I say, okay, let's follow Kolmogorov's cascade upwards all the way to the larger scale. That would predict this type of velocities in this case. Make sense?
No.
let's see. How could I do that?
Well, it's saying that if you have a certain dissipation, that power being dissipated has to be manifest at a larger scale on that time scale.
Yeah. In other words, it's what's written here, in fact. The relationship you get from that, from Kolmogorov's cascade, is that the large-scale velocity should scale like something which might be called useful or something, power divided by mass of the outer core times the radius of the outer core to the power 1/3. Which is basically, you've given the energy to the system, it's kinetic energy you get if you refill it every times it has made one vortex over 2 times.
So if I increase the power, say 2 terawatts, that line should move down.
Yes, exactly.
The blue line should move
down. Exactly.
But not very much because...
This is a lot of thin.
So the right side is anchored by the radius of the outer core.
Right.
And the left side is anchored by the assumption
You cannot independently.
You cannot. Okay, so the right
that slope is fixed.
The right side is anchored. Okay, the right edge, the right point. Yeah, the slope is fixed by the scaling law, the turbulent scaling law.
Yeah.
And then the right corner is placed by the radius of the outer core and the time scale for variation of magnetic of the Earth.
I think they solved the time scale.
Not even. It's a prediction. Knowing only the geometry, that is the size of the inner core
and its mass,
I can calculate if I have that power dissipated, what will be the largest?
So you can compute the violet line, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And each point on this line corresponds to a given power, right?
Yeah.
And then so you can assume a power and then start drawing a line at that power with the right slope. You hit the right edge of the plot, and that gives you a prediction for you not.
But we know something about this time scale in the Earth.
Yes.
So why not do it the other way?
You can go the other way.
Why not go the other way? Is that what you did for the Earth?
And then you know the power was dissipated, right?
So that's where the statement comes that the power dissipation is 1 terawatt.
Yeah.
Because you know the time scale for changing of the Earth's magnetic field, and you know the spatial scale for the radius of the outer core.
So what is that?
And then you know the scaling law, the Kolmogorov scaling law.
Scale of variations over 400 years.
Sorry?
The time scale that you get it from those long-term variations of the magnetic field of the Earth, right?
Yeah, well, so far I haven't put the observations, but you're right. Observations would give us here a typical time scale for the velocity field of about 300, 400 years.
Yeah, so just to be clear, once you set ROC U dot, you have set the power.
Right.
There's no choice after that. Then it's just a question of what scaling is dissipated.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And U naught is the typical fluid velocity in the core.
Yes.
On large scales.
Yeah. And that's something which we can have constraint on. But again, we would be more interested in the intensity of the magnetic field. Are you with us?
Yes, I have one. Tell me about the magenta line again.
That one?
No.
That's the other one, sorry.
Yeah.
This is a viscous dissipation line. In other words, it's a relation I've written here. It tells you that the typical diffusion time scale for a structure of time size L is simply L squared over diffusivity, viscous. And the only thing I had, which is a bit new, is this graduation of that line in terms of power. which will tell us once our flow velocity, which is the vortex turnover time, intersect that line, we know what diffusion. What power we have.
What does W stand for there?
Watt. It's watt. 1 watt.
Watt. Oh, okay. So I should read
1 watt.
1 terawatt, 1 giga, mega, kilo.
Oh, okay. It's factors of 10^3
yes.
are dots.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. We can also end.
So I know this is just turbulence. This is not magnetic field yet. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. But if we add the magnetic diffusion line, the same one as the magenta one, but for the magnetic field. And if we have the same type of Kolmogorov flow, which is just an exercise at this stage, we can do the same thing. This is the magnetic diffusion line, and because magnetic diffusivity is much larger, we also, at a given scale, let's say L, dissipate much more. So the terawatt point is now here than what it was for the viscosity, right? And concerning, talking about dissipation of the magnetic field this time, not the velocity field, right? And that's because I've put this red line, which is now the magnetic field intensity translated in terms of alpha wave velocity, so that we can have everything in the same.
Yeah, so if you add another diffusive process, then you make the inner scale of the turbulence larger, and so the inertial range gets smaller.
Yes, exactly. That's what we see for the magnetic field. Is very clear that if, so forget about
the inertial range is just the red part.
Yeah, so forget about that line first for now. Just have the red line, which might be or not be the kind of a cascade you expect for the magnetic field intensity following some kind of Kolmogorov flow. If we have it sustained by some like 1 terawatt power input, we would predict then that it has an alpha wave velocity, which gives us this typical time scale, at the integral scale. And it turns out that that particular time scale is exactly the one, exactly not because there are some prefactors, but it's the same type of relationship that one Eric has been using from deriving from this simulation, numerical simulations. Power divided by mass multiplied by radius to the power 1/3.
Actually, get back to Andrea's question. The turbulence you would expect to continue, right, along the below the diffusivity inner scale, the turbulence would continue, just that the field lines would decouple and wouldn't care about that turbulence. So am I getting that picture wrong?
I think we probably, I'm not sure, but you're saying the, in principle here you've kind of got rid of the small scale magnetic field is being dissipated.
Yeah, then the field basically is no longer cares about turbulence on a scale smaller than that. It's basically slipping right past it.
Yeah, but you can still have some.
But you have still the turbulence.
Kinetic turbulence.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why I've continued, in fact, that line. I think, in print, well, it depends. If the magnetic field is not too strong, then you think that the action of the Lorentz force on the flow will be not too strong. That's given by another parameter, the interaction parameter, version that is basically. The intensity, well, the inertial terms over Lorentz force terms. If that term is small, then turbulence, hydrodynamic turbulence, doesn't care about magnetic field. And that's why I've continued that line. And in fact, in that case, you find that if you had these two in equipartition here, that is, magnetic energy, kinetic energy of same order, you would expect that the magnetic energy can get dissipated down to scales of kilometers or so. But in principle, the hydrodynamic turbulence would go on and intersect the diffusion line at much smaller scale still. Which is a bit strange, because it means that even though we have a magnetic Prandtl number of 10 to minus 6, we have equipartition in energy and in dissipation, which is not usually what we assume. Usually we would say, and in fact, extrapolating from numerical simulation, concentrate on the magnetic field because we think that kinetic dissipation, viscous dissipation is negligible. It's probably not the case in numerical simulations. We'll see that it could be, it's probably the case for the Earth because we haven't put all the ingredients yet.
As the magnetic field decouples, it takes some energy out at that field, so at that scale, so that the hydrodynamic part of turbulence would pick up its scaling law at a lower energy?
Yes, you're saying that if I understand. This line should be kind of
offset
a little bit,
right?
Because we've lost some energy here.
Yeah, you're right.
And some simulations have tried to address this question. You would, in fact, lose some energy, but not that much. So you still would have to dissipate like maybe 1/10 of that, which is already quite less.
Oh, you're saying at that scale you'd go by factor 10?
You'd jump like this and follow on then with less power to dissipate.
It's kind of a lot. It seems like a lot at that scale.
Well, yeah, the scale is, it's, you know, orders of magnitude. Okay, so I wanted to make this point because this gives us another possible view on this relationship derived from numerical simulation. This can give us a simple mnemotechnic type thing. It's basically what you would get if you had a Kolmogorov cascade from magnetic diffusion all the way up, not caring about the kinetic energy. Okay,
so so for us observers, it would really be important to know what's going on at the low end of it, because we want to have some observables that emerge from what happens on the large scales. This is what we observe.
Yeah, that's still possible. I mean, if all we were to get from this diagram is this relationship, that would still work. I mean, it would tell you, if you know what is the mass radius on power input in your core, you can derive some typical magnetic field intensity, which it happens to be the same as what you get from the numerical simulations. But the problem is that I think some ingredients are missing from this picture, in particular rotation, we haven't talked about yet. And also the fact, which is very important for the Earth, which I mentioned already, that we don't have equipartition of energy for the Earth's core. We have a magnetic energy which is like 10,000 times larger than the kinetic energy at the large scale. So that's a main problem. In the Earth, the typical flow velocity I mentioned is like 300 meters. And we know, for reasons which probably I won't have time to explain, that the Alphen wave velocity is of order a few years. And so the energies, which are the square of these things, are in the ratio of about 10 to 4. I've already shown you that, where we have this ratio, again, if you just take the inverse of the square of that, tells you that velocities are much smaller than magnetic typical velocities for the Earth, which we can't reach with numerical simulations. But we can try to put this in our diagrams. They've been built to go beyond what we can do with numerical simulations in terms of parameter range, but of course with very simplistic approaches.
So your previous plot corresponded to moving the blue dot of the Earth up to 10 to the 0?
Right.
Just that.
Yeah,
right.
You're right. Yeah. So, again, saying that, the other problems we have with what we've seen so far is that turbulence should be strongly modified by the presence of that very strong magnetic field. Then you have no reason to expect that the hydrodynamic turbulence doesn't care about the magnetic field because it's a dominant effect. And also turbulence should be strongly modified by the rotation of the planet, which we haven't put yet in. So, a few words about MHD turbulence, and that gets a bit more unknown territories. It is thought by people working on magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, and there are people really working hard on that, that there are some differences with hydrodynamic turbulence. In a sense, in hydrodynamic turbulence, what counts are these kind of eddies, which are transferring energy from large eddies to small eddies, like Richardson said a long time ago. In magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, where you have a strong impulse magnetic field, it's expected that the Alphen waves are doing this job of transferring the large-scale energy to the small-scale by colliding. We think that the simple Alphen waves are non-dispersive and they do not lose their energy by collisions. But in fact, when you look in more detail, there are some nonlinear terms like b, the large scale b times gradient small b, in the Navier-Stokes equation, or that term is the induction equation. This can lead to some transfer of energy from the large scale to the small scales. And people have tried to derive what are the laws which emerge from that, and it's different from Kolmogorov's cascade, although it's still a cascade from large energies to large scales to small scales. And so I put here nothing interesting. Okay, so we've tried to take this idea and put forward what would be the scenario for the Earth if we input again 1 terawatt of power and have it dissipate by strong energy terminals with no rotation field. The slope is the one which is predicted for strong turbulence. It's still supposed to be in equipartition, that is, here we have both magnetic energy and kinetic energy which are about equal. And these magnetic waves, these alpha waves, should dissipate all the way until you get to this strange point. So you might expect it could go to this point. In fact, it should rather go to here, the intersection of the large scale field with the diffusion time. That's when you get a Lundquist number. Waves then get attenuated by dissipation. They've done their role to go all the way to dissipation. It happens to be more around that length scale than around this one. And after that, in that case, we still are in a regime when the magnetic field is strong. And so we don't have this cascade of hydrodynamic turbulence all the way. Instead, we have a flow which we more or less know, which is turbulence under the action of a strong magnetic field. That has a slope of k minus 3, something, which corresponds here to some flat line. That is, we dissipate here at the large scale, and nothing is left to the small scales, which then would predict that we have very small viscous dissipation in that regime as compared to the magnetic diffusion dissipation, which is here. I've lost about everybody, I think. Let me see if I can try to sum up things a bit. Okay, well, this is a sum up, I think. So this is the final diagram we've drawn for the Earth, in which this time we also take into account rotation. And rotation appears to have a very strong role, because in the previous diagram I showed you what we get with only MHD turbulence, which would yield, by the way, to some, it's not that one, to some quite slow magnetic field, that is, low intensity magnetic field. The actual one is around here. So this one would be like 10 times smaller. It's not that big, if that were true. But rotation, because it corresponds to a short time scale, has the power that it kills this propagation of alpha waves. In other words, the mechanism which was invoked as being the main thing for the equivalent of hydrodynamic turbulence in MHD, the collision of alpha waves, cannot exist in the Earth's core because alpha waves cannot propagate. They are inhibited by rotation. There is only one sort of alpha waves which can propagate. They are called torsional oscillations, because they respect the constraints put forward by rotation. And they correspond to this thing. Maybe I should show you that because it's more fun. It's going to be tired if listening to me. Okay. This is a small movie of the discovery of this torsional oscillation. It's a recent discovery by colleagues from my team, it happens. Nicolas Agile and others. Yes. I want to start the movie. And these are, hope this can show you.
Just the play at the bottom.
Yeah, go to the bottom of your screen.
Ah, yes, I'm stupid. I look it on my screen, I should look it up here, of course. Okay. So we are looking at things on the time scale of years, like 1953, this is the year 54, 55. And you see inside the core, what we've shown here is the azimuthal velocity with colors.
I don't see anything in the core.
This is the core.
Oh, I always see the core.
And this is the inner core.
Okay.
And we see some waves which are propagating like outwards from the inner core to the outer core.
You play it again because I need to reset.
And the colors give you both the sign and the intensity of the color, of the flow.
So are we seeing...
But this rotational velocity is...
So is this fluid motion or is it a magnetic field?
It's fluid motions derived from observations of the magnetic field at the surface in a subtle way. And they show you that the propagation of these waves is kind of fast. I mean, it's like a few years, like 4 or 5 years.
So we're looking at the magnitude of the phi component of the velocity.
Yes. And so it looks like a lot like a sinusoid.
So this would be called differential rotation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's cylinders which are moving like one, like shearing each other and propagating from the out. So this is an alpha wave. If you think of some magnetic field lines piercing the core this way in the equatorial plane, you take it like this and you let it go. You propagate a wave which will go from inside to outside, for example.
So it's a shear wave.
It's alpha waves are transverse waves. So yeah, it's kind of a shear wave if you want. Yeah, transverse wave.
And is it? I understand from the word discovery and the time being in years that this is inferred to exist on the Earth, not just seen in simulations, right?
Yeah, this is deduced from the construction of core flows from surface magnetic observations. And one thing which makes us very confident that this really is a single leak there, that these waves transfer some angular momentum between the core and the mantle, which means that it also corresponds to some acceleration or deceleration of the length of the day. And that's measured very precisely. And the prediction from these models fits perfectly well in phase and amplitude the variation of the length of the day. And that gives us, for the first time, some more quantitative evaluation of what is the intensity of the magnetic field inside the core, not only the part we see at the surface, but the part which is hidden inside the core. And that's of the order of 3 millitesla or so. So like 10 times larger than the field which actually gets out of the core.
I don't understand why a wave propagating through the core will affect the rotation rate of the surface of the Earth.
Oh, transfer of angular momentum.
How is angular momentum being transmitted? It's just a dinky little wave on top of a humongous background.
Yeah.
What's the background?
I mean, the fractional change in mass of this wave is trivial.
No, because it's
it's angular momentum.
It's really in the volume of the core. It's not the surface thing. It's really these big cylinders are inside the core. But you're right. I mean, it's a small signal. This is the signal you get, in fact. So this is the length of the day. The data is a green thing, I guess, and the prediction of this model is the red line. And you see the amplitude here is like 0.1 millisecond signal. It's not loud, but it's measured very precisely. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Why would I believe this is the cause of those changes?
Oh, that's a good question. Because when you look at the global curve of currents of the day, you can explain lots of things by atmospheric circulation, transfer of angular momentum into the atmosphere, on the surface and ocean circulation and things, but there was no good explanation for signals at this particular decimal type timescales.
So it's because there's a long timescale component
that
you try to tie it to something?
Yeah, and also because we've seen this correlation, which are really quite striking. So.
But I mean, why don't I just believe there's something complicated in the oceans on a long timescale?
El Niño.
El Niño is taken into account in this simulation. You have pretty good models of.
We can't model El Niño. Why should I believe you subtract El Niño?
Why do you believe that from the precession of Mercury you can derive that general relativity?
Well, because that's simple.
No, it's not simple.
That's
yeah.
Physics. No, that's nice simple physics. This
that's
simple.
So cool.
No, it's complicated.
No, I mean, this question of the torsional oscillation, it's really something which you can't escape to mention. I mentioned the rotation of the Earth inhibits all the types of alpha waves. You could have alpha waves propagating like this, for example, but then they would violate the constraints put forward by rotation, which basically tells you that you can't have variations along the axis of rotation. Yeah. So it's a very strong constraint. And on the other hand, there is nothing that prevents these torsional oscillations, which are one particular type of alpha waves, to be present. Just need to excite them somewhere, and that we don't know exactly how it happens symmetry. But you see, I mean, the amplitudes are not large, like points. It corresponds to velocities of 0.4 kilometers per year. Not the propagation, just the how much azimuthal motions you have. Okay, I think I should conclude, probably. It's time. And I just wanted to zap some very simple but fun thing about reversals, and I will stop with that, because some colleagues have proposed something. So the magnetic field of the Earth reverses, we all know that. Magnetic field of the Sun reverses, that's clear as well. And it turns out that magnetic reversals have been observed in one particular dynamo experiment run by some French colleagues, and they had this paper in 2007. And they proposed some kind of scaling which would put all this together, and that's kind of fun.
So what was special at that experiment that caused it to reverse in other ones?
Well, there are not that many dynamo experiments that work. The VKS experiment is for von Karman, is two disks which can spin in front of each other with different velocity. And you get reversals when the two disks are not spinning at the same velocity. So it's a bit like if you had some global velocity plus some differential velocity. And you think that's what causes these reversals. And they put forward this kind of scaling law from this ID. So this is the inverse of the Rossby number I've written. So in other words, here you have large global rotation and small differential rotation or typical velocities. And at that scale, like here, you have the Sun, let's say, equal differential rotation and global rotation, and even larger motions, less affected by rotation. And they've put here the frequency of reversal divided by the typical rotation frequency of the star, for example. They've done that for, you see, for all sorts of objects, from the Earth all the way to the experiments. Their experiments is this type of red dots and black dots. These are for stars, various stars, including the Sun. These are binary objects, I'm not sure what they are in their case. And they kind of find a relationship with values which are like, this is 10 to minus 3, so this is already pretty long time, that's 1,000 rotation times. So I don't know what is the prospect of observing things in this type of length scales. Well, no, it was possible for these particular objects. For exoplanets, I don't know exactly where it would be. If we are any close to here, this would make mean like a million years. If we are closer to there, it's more differential rotation comparable with global rotation, which is a bit unexpected, maybe. But for these very strange exoplanets, maybe. Then we might have reversal rate like 10 to the minus, what is there? 10 minus 1, I guess. That is 10 rotation periods.
Okay, so you've successfully convinced me it's really complicated, and I should be skeptical of anything I hear. So, what are the three things that you're most confident of about dynamos that I should actually believe?
They're complicated.
Okay, that you want to use one of your three on that?
No. So I'm sorry, that's not really the message I wanted to convey. Of course, everybody's field is always complicated, otherwise you wouldn't be working at it. But no, the idea that some things which are pretty simple. I think that this idea of relating intensity of the field to the available power is a good guide. But in the end, even these complications I've shown for the Earth, I think they are important because, for example, they make you understand why you would be able to have a dynamo which has much more magnetic energy than kinetic energy, but still for our big picture it's not such a problem. You don't care about the flow inside an exoplanet if you just want to know about the magnetic field. You are not making a big error in taking that relationship, I think.
So, but you showed us again three different ones. Mm-hmm. What is important, power or rotation or both? So what is,
I think that they are not that different. The second one I had for the magnetospheric equilibrium, there was the influence of rotation, the role of rotation, but you also had some connection with available power. And you don't find such a difference in the law you get out of that. So, and in what we've derived, these turbulence relationships, they don't give like one order of magnitude difference, okay, but it's probably not much more than that, and that's probably all we need for many applications, I think. Again, what is more important is for the Earth, this question of how do we get dynamo working with so little kinetic energy? That's a big question. But for this application to planets, I think that once you are in a regime, at least, which has the effect of strong rotations, that you are a bit like in the region of the Earth, you might have proper relationship with what we have. If rotation is less important, you would get something different, but not fundamentally different, I think. You still basically want to use your power available, which I haven't talked about, is linked to what happens in the mantle and so on, to produce a magnetic field, which is, at the large scale, the magnetic field you would have if you take as a time scale the alpha wave time. That's the same thing is what, right, but you shouldn't assume that the power is all used to make the large scale magnetic field, like a dipole. If you look at the dissipation term of magnetic dipole of Earth, it's only a few megawatts. It has no connection with the available power because you have this cascade still. But you have it in the numerical simulation somewhat, you have it in these different estimates. So if you take that ingredient into account, you're not making such a big error.
So when you say available power, is that basically gravitational potential energy being converted into energy, or is that something else?
It's something else. It's more related to the global thermal history of the planet. And that's where it gets complicated and where Eric could have told us, or Luis. So it has to do with how, and Bruce explained that, I think, how the mantle is transferring heat. That is, you have to start with the gravitational energy which is put into your planet. You add some radioactive
elements. This is the whole thing, it's the rate at which the heat is escaping from the core rather than... And so basically, since we have no idea how the mantle behaves as we scale the planet, we have no idea how the available power scales either.
Well, I wouldn't say we have no idea. It's complex, but we can try the exercise, and people have done that. Mm-hmm.
But in the Earth, it's true that only a small fraction of that power is used to generate the magnetic field?
Well, because of this large portion which is just carried along the adiabatic gradient, yes. And that will be true for other planets.
And still, energetically, the magnetic field dominates over convective motions, right? By four orders of magnitude.
Apparently, yes.
In the core.
Apparently, yes.
Not in the mantle.
Okay, but in the core, the magnetic energy is four orders of magnitude higher than the turbulent kinetic energy.
At the large scale, that's which we can observe. There still is a possibility that, in fact, after at small scales, things get more comparable, the magnetic energy and the kinetic energy, I would say it's not very likely, but it's not... impossible when you just look at the numerical simulation. They have rather that, but we are not in the same region.
Well, there is this interesting correlation from a little bit different ballpark. That is, if you plot, and that has been done for many objects, and I'm talking about brown dwarfs and very low mass stars. If you plot the radial luminosity or the ratio of radial luminosity to total luminosity of the star versus the Rossby number, there's a very strong, a very nice correlation. That is, the radio output goes up as the Rossby number decreases. It has a very nice negative slope. How would you, as a theorist, interpret that in terms of what the magnetic field is contributing to this? It must be.
Let's see, I have...
The Rossby number that gives you the idea about what the convection does.
I'm leaving on Friday morning, but I have 2 days to see this question with you as I can say. Okay. I'd be happy to do it.
Well, there is internet always that we can reach.
Okay, no, that's good. I've really tried to be in the program to project myself in the exoplanet world, but it's not always easy, but I'm very happy to be in this direction.
So in the end, you gave a scaling law for field reversals.
Yeah.
But what is the mechanism? Why does the field reverse at all? Why is it not... kind of static and...
That's a good question. The short answer is that we don't really know. This was kind of an empirical relationship just based on this idea of putting things together and looking. The idea that the Rossby number would be important is not that ridiculous because you think that it's what... it's kind of the instability, the trigger of instability. Now I think we don't understand well enough reversals for the Earth, for sure, even for the Sun. It's not that clear, it seems to me, that we can extrapolate, but have strong physical grounds on which to do this.
But it may be worth mentioning that one big difference is that the Earth's magnetic field, the Sun's magnetic field reverses on a very regular time scale, and the Earth does not. It's a
very chaotic time.
Really chaotic.
Which is surprising because, of course, the Sun seems to have much more activity than the core, but...
But it's really variable.
Well, astronomy, the Sun is variable too, right? I mean, it's not that it's periodic.
It's completely
but it's
actually,
maybe 30% or sort of this difference from one cycle to the next.
I see, yeah.
So on the Earth, is it? Could you characterize it by saying that it's a Poisson process, that it's...
Yes.
There
are some long-term variations which people have been trying to relate to some things happening in the mantle, but otherwise the spectrum gets pretty much the distribution gets for a Poisson ratio.
So somebody said in a talk that the Earth magnetic field tries to reverse many times and gets back and gets back, and then one time it gets pushed over the limit, so to speak, and then it reverses and then it stays there. And so that means it's more or less chaotic, and the fluctuations are of the same order of magnitude as the field.
Maybe not quite, but you certainly have some what they call excursions, which happen quite often and which do not go all the way to reversal. But they're still not that common. I mean, you can get more, of course, than the reversal, but they're still not so common.
How do you measure the frequency of reversals in things that aren't the Earth or the Sun? So that had a lot of things, right?
I don't think so. For stars, maybe, or something. For planets, we don't have anything.
Well, if you go back to that plot,
sorry?
The plot on the previous slide, what were all those data from?
Oh yeah, sorry, it tends to start as binary objects.
Yeah, binary objects. So how do you, I just don't know how you measure that.
I'm not sure either. I think in fact it's not reversal really, it's more like oscillation, some type of measure, some type of activity. Where is that? No. Where is it?
Could be the star spot cycle.
Yeah, probably.
Yes, something like that, I think. Let me just see. I can't find. I look at the legend here.
So, just how frequently the star spot cycle? Some of those frequencies seem really low. Right? Yeah, how do you convert this to years?
Oh, to years.
So F is the frequency of rotation, and F reversals is. Frequency of reversals. So, for young stars, their frequency is one per day or something, maybe less than that. But
per day of the star.
Rotation frequency.
No, it would be more like this is like 10^-4, so it's like 1 10,000 rotations.
Exactly. So then you're talking about years.
Yeah. And for the Sun, it's like 0.01, so it's. I guess it's a ratio of 22 years, 11 years compared to
30 days. Okay, well that sounds like we're starting to go into detail, so maybe get to follow up individually. Thanks.